This is Michael Brennan with Catholic Radio in South Carolina. We have a special guest today, Robert E. Guglielmone, Bishop of the Diocese of Charleston. And today we're going to be talking about the crisis in the church. Your Excellency, this all started really again. We've been through this before, but it all started again when an investigation found credible evidence that Cardinal McCarrick had sexually abused a teenage altar boy 47 years ago while serving as a priest in New York. Former Archbishop of Washington was the first cardinal to step down because of sexual abuse allegations. Since late July, Your Excellency, you must have been inundated with emails, letters, etc. How would you describe the tenor of those communiques?
Well, Michael, it's good to be with you, and certainly that's a good question. The tenor was varied. Many of the inquiries, letters, emails, etc., expressed tremendous anger at the various revelations, not only the Cardinal McCarrick revelation about 47 years ago, but also in terms of the instances with seminarians, and then, of course, the Pennsylvania grand jury report. So all of that created a lot of churning within the hearts of many, many people. So I would say that there was a great bit of anger, but there was also a number of letters of support indicating that, you know, so much of this had happened prior to the 2002 Dallas Charter, and that since that time, many have seen the church make some great strides in terms of addressing the issue. The biggest concern that I had with all of this was not so much the Pennsylvania reports of all of the abuse that had happened, because that had all occurred many, many years ago, and we were pretty much aware of those things. The fact that the report was so graphic disturbed me greatly, not knowing exactly what these allegations were, but that report made it very clear. But the thing that upset me more than anything was all of the disinformation that there were folks who knew that Cardinal McCarrick was doing things, especially with seminarians, and that was never reported or talked about or didn't seem to stand in the way of his advancing in the church, becoming the bishop of one of the most influential dioceses in the United States, Washington, D.C., and even becoming a cardinal. That really tore me apart. With knowledge that this man could advance and be so much a prominent player in the work of the church, despite the fact that there were so many people who knew there were problems.
Can you briefly describe for listeners, how does one rise through the ranks exactly?
To tell you the truth, I don't know. When someone is named bishop, they're vetted rather carefully. There's all kinds of investigation into the person's background, etc. I would assume that the same thing would be true if someone is going to be named a cardinal in the church or advanced to a major archdiocese such as D.C. So I would have to say that I find it very, very difficult to understand how that could have happened without someone knowing about it. And then, of course, in the Archbishop Vigano letter, there is indication that he says the Holy Father, Pope Francis, knew about it. That letter was kind of confusing in some areas. I mean, he made some accusations that in some ways I could understand, but then there were some others that I thought were rather far-reaching. So that's why I wrote to the nuncio asking that there has to be some clarity to this. What actually happened? Who knew what? When? Why did this happen? And I'm simply echoing the call by Cardinal DiNardo, who is constantly asking Rome these days for clarification and a total investigation as to how this might have happened. So I'm supportive of Cardinal DiNardo's attempts to have the Holy Father instigate an investigation and for the Holy Father himself to comment on the charges that Archbishop Vigano made.
Pope Francis, on the way back from Ireland, said he would not say a word. In fact, he said that Archbishop Vigano's letter speaks for itself. I'm not quite sure what that means, Bishop, but do you have any comments on that?
Well, Michael, I would agree with you. I don't know what it means either. I mean, there's all kinds of speculation. I can't read into the mind of the Holy Father. Perhaps it was a knee-jerk response because he had only learned of the letter that very day. But I can't say why. I do know, just recently, the Vatican has indicated that there will be a clarification about that letter in the very near future. I do know that the Holy Father is, as we speak, I know that there's preparation for a meeting with Cardinal DiNardo, Cardinal O'Malley, Archbishop Gomez, concerning these very issues, and perhaps there will be some sort of a Vatican explanation of all of this in the very near future. That's my hope. That's my prayer.
Before we get away from reaction, there was an open letter at one point of lay Catholics, and they actually asked fellow Catholics to consider whether or not they should withhold diocesan contributions in order to bring to bear an effective form of influence over bishops to address this issue. That kind of response from the laity is really unprecedented in Catholic circles, but how would you address this particular item?
Well, I did respond to the original author of that letter and to anyone who sent copies of that letter to me. I had indicated that there could be a number of possibilities as to why the folks would be hoping to withhold a donation to the church. First would be to provide pressure in the hopes of denying contributions to the diocese, that there might be pressure on bishops to actually go into these problems and to rectify them, to make a change, to stop all of the talk and to create some strong action. That could be one of the motivations for the letter. And I can understand people wanting to do that in the hopes that this pressure would force the bishops to that change. The other reasoning that could be part of their response is that some people wonder what happens to the money that they donate. Is that money being used to pay off lawsuits, to take care of those who are suing the various dioceses? And are their contributions then going to be used not for the work of the church, not for the ministry of the church, but rather to pay off the lawsuits that have been charged against the various dioceses? And in that case, I can say that in our own diocese, for I can't speak for any other diocese except our own, that's just not the case. None of the monies that people offer directly to the diocese is used to pay off settlements that have been made or will be made.
The other thing I gleaned from your letter, August 31st, you say, also, I wholeheartedly endorse every effort to reform and renew our initiatives to protect survivors and allowing the National Review Board to serve as an independent entity that will review allegations made against bishops. This work must be entrusted to the laity. Why so?
Oh, I just believe for an objective view of the problem. I mean, to me, it's just common sense. If you have a bishop who is accused of something, it doesn't make sense for other bishops to be the ones who will investigate and who will deal with these problems. The same thing with priests and priests who are accused. It shouldn't be clergy who are making the determinations as to the credibility or non-credibility of these issues. I really believe it belongs to the laity, who I believe certainly have a vested interest. I mean, they're certainly a very, very important part of the church. And I don't believe that priests and bishops should be the ones to make these determinations. So I agree with that. On a national level, a national review board, and then certainly on a diocesan level. We've had a sexual abuse advisory board in the Diocese of Charleston, oh my goodness, for almost 20 years now. And it is comprised primarily of lay people. There's one priest who serves on that board, but the other seven folks and the chairman of that particular group are lay people. Lay people who are invested in various works of the church, who are asked to be part of this board, and certainly they have reviewed every allegation that has occurred in this diocese since the inception of the board.
And that really addresses, too, that open letter. That was one of the things that most of these people who had this open letter, that's what they were really pushing for, and you were already for it.
Oh, absolutely, 100%. I'm not one who believes that the clergy should have complete and absolute control over everything. I mean, this is a church where we're all part of it, and the laity have a very specific role in this and should not be excluded at all, especially in areas where there could be difficulties with clergy. The laity have to be the ones who are doing the investigating and the determination.
Now, before we get away from that letter, one of the things that we should mention is Catholic teaching with regard to support for the church. We are required as Catholics to support our parishes and our clergy, correct?
Yes, that is true.
Mm-hmm. But what you're suggesting is that from your perspective, it was okay, at least as a short-term measure, to apply pressure?
Oh, yeah, I can understand that. I don't know if it's a good thing because there is collateral damage with that. You know, you might be making the point in terms of withholding donations, but let's face it, I mean, the work of the church is important. And with all of the difficulties we're facing with these allegations and the abuse of children and vulnerable adults, that does not negate all the good work that the church does in terms of our schools, in terms of Catholic charities, in terms of outreach in all areas. So if folks withhold all of the donations, they're making a point. There's no question about that. But there's also some collateral damage if over a long period of time that continues, because we need the resources to do the work of the church.
And we've been talking about the laity and their anger. What about priests and religious? They must be angry as well.
Absolutely, Michael. There's no question about that. We in the Diocese of Charleston hosted just recently a provincial assembly of priests and bishops. Most folks realize that we are part of a province, five dioceses with a metropolitan archbishop who is responsible for these five dioceses. And that metropolitan archbishop is Archbishop Wilton Gregory of Atlanta. And we gathered with priests and bishops of all five dioceses, Savannah, Atlanta, Charleston, Charlotte, and Raleigh. Here in Charleston, we hosted it, and we had well over 150 priests in attendance with the bishops, and we did address this issue as part of the whole program. And there's certainly anger and disappointment and hurt among the priests in so many ways. First of all, in terms of brother priests who may have done horrible things, but also anger against bishops who covered it up. And then, of course, tremendous anger in terms of the whole Archbishop McCarrick situation. So that was expressed, and that certainly is a very, very important part of this, too. It's not just the laity who are terribly upset with this, but so are our priests and religious and deacons. It hurts us all in the church.
How about seminarians?
Well, it's interesting. I've called every one of our seminarians. In fact, I'm in the process right now. I have a few more that I have to reach out to, and I've had personal telephone conversations with all of them. They were appreciative of my call, and certainly I asked them very, very clearly. I says, you know, have you experienced any kind of a boundary violation? And none of them have. Interestingly enough, they all felt that while they were terribly hurt with all of this, they also see that this is, in a sense, a call to a deeper sense of holiness for themselves. I felt hopeful in talking with them that while they're hurt, while they're having tremendous difficulty in dealing with this, that they're still hopeful, they're still committed to their vocation in the sense of saying they need to strive for holiness and faithfulness and loyalty even more.
Let's talk about the allegations made by Archbishop Carlo Vigano, former Vatican ambassador to Washington. That makes
right.
him a church insider, right?
It does. We call him a papal nuncio. He's the Pope's representative to the church in the United States. So he served in that capacity for 5 years. I always saw him to be a very decent human being, a wonderful archbishop. I was really surprised when all of this happened. But obviously, he must have some information in terms of how all of this is playing out.
Well, in short or in brief, he basically said the Pope was informed about Cardinal McCarrick, and he also had a long list of Vatican and U.S. church officials who supposedly knew about McCarrick's misconduct ongoing. In your letter to the papal nuncio, you encouraged Pope Francis to directly respond to the statements. Let me ask you this. Why did you make such a request, and why do you think it's so important for the Pope to deal with this directly, even though he hasn't at this point?
Well, first of all, I mean, there were a number of accusations that Archbishop Vigano made. It's quite possible that some of them are true. Perhaps some of them are clouded in terms of his own recollection and understanding. But he made a very direct accusation against Pope Francis, actually called him to resign. And I think that's pretty important. When that kind of an accusation is made, I mean, against a pope, I mean, that's almost unheard of in these days where a pope is asked to resign. I think that the Holy Father owes all of us, the entire church, a statement from his own perspective as to what happened. And the investigation that Cardinal Donato is calling for should lead us to documentation of what the truth really is. Yes, I believe the Holy Father has an obligation to respond to the charge that Archbishop Vigano made specifically against him. And that's the reason I wrote the letter to the nuncio, because his statement of saying that he will not speak about it just doesn't cut the mustard. I'm sorry. That just doesn't work.
What about the allegation that Pope Emeritus Benedict had actually sanctioned Cardinal McCarrick, and those sanctions were then lifted by Pope Francis? There seems to be some confusion about that.
Well, that is the basic issue. First of all, did Pope Francis know about it? Secondly, did he lift sanctions? But you know, there was an additional statement by Archbishop Vigano that came out probably about a week after his original letter, saying that Pope Benedict's restrictions upon Archbishop McCarrick were private. Now, to tell you the truth, I don't know what that means. And this was a statement from Archbishop Vigano. Now, was it that Pope Benedict had suggested to Archbishop McCarrick that he go into a life of prayer and penance? That doesn't seem to be the case, because McCarrick was active in so many other circumstances, even with Benedict himself. So there's just so much confusion with all of this, and that's why I believe an investigation is necessary to clear the air. Let's find out what the truth is, and let's deal with it, whatever that truth is.
And to be fair, Archbishop Vigano, critics have said that he's upset with the Pope because he wasn't made cardinal. None of these allegations have been proven, but we have to point out that critics have pointed out some inconsistencies.
Like I say, I don't know Archbishop Vigano well enough to impute anything to his character. I mean, I had only the best relationships with him, you know, when he was the nuncio. But some of the accusations he makes are not clear. And whether that's lapse of memory, whether that's some sort of anger at not being made a cardinal, I have no idea. But that's why I think we need an investigation.
Let's move to the Diocese of Charleston and the past, because many of these allegations that came out were essentially in the past. What
Yes.
has the Diocese of Charleston done in the past related to allegations of sexual misconduct against church personnel?
Well, the diocese has had a policy for protecting children and young people since 1994. That was the initial policy. It was updated in 2003 and again in 2012. And every few years, we continually look at the policy. It is looked at not only by our own Child Protection Office, but also by the Sexual Abuse Advisory Board, which I referred to in the past. And so we would soon be looking at another possibility of updating the policy. The policy states that when we receive an allegation, an investigation by civil authorities or an independent investigator begins. If the victim is a minor, we contact the civil authorities. We ask everyone who brings an allegation to go to the police initially. Whether they do or not, the diocese does. Second thing we do is we offer professional counseling to the victim immediately. We don't wait for an allegation to be provided with the designation as credible. Anyone who brings the allegation, we would offer professional counseling. If a priest is accused, he's placed on administrative leave during the investigation. He cannot function as a priest. He can't wear clerical attire. He cannot participate in parish activities until the investigation is complete and it is deemed not credible. If it's deemed credible, well, then we have to follow up in terms of church policies, and certainly civil follow-up would be the responsibility of the civil authorities. About 10 years ago, the diocese entered into a $12 million class action settlement agreement, and this allowed for a non-confrontation path for survivors, victims of clerical sexual abuse, to report this abuse, to receive professional counseling and financial compensation. As part of that settlement, all priest personnel files were reviewed and audited, and all of the findings were shared with the civil authorities. And that's the way it would continue. If there is any allegation, report it to the police, offer counseling, investigate, and follow up. And that's been our policy very clearly since 2002.
Have you had the unfortunate occasion to remove a priest from, we'll call it duty?
Yes, we have. We've had one case where we found the allegation to be credible. Our investigation indicated it was substantiated. It was reported to police, even though the survivor chose not to follow through and prosecute. But we follow through in Rome, and the priest has been laicized since then.
What is the diocese doing now to protect children in its care?
Well, my goodness, we try to do a lot of things, you know. The United States Conference of Catholic Bishops and its Charter for the Protection of Children and Young People calls us to do certain things. First of all, every year we are audited by the United States Conference to ensure that we are complying with the Charter, all of the regulations of the Charter, all of the reporting that I had indicated to you. We're audited every year to ensure that we're in compliance. We've passed this audit every year for the past 16 years. We have an Office of Child Protection, and its only function is to manage the protection of children and young people in our parishes and schools. That office oversees a safe environment program that we offer to children in our Catholic schools, in our religious education programs, in our youth ministry programs, and we try to get young people to understand that they have a right to feel comfortable in the presence of adults. And if there is anything that happens where that comfort is broken, that they should talk about it. Every full-time employee, every volunteer who has access to children must undergo a background screening, and they must attend child abuse prevention education. Additionally, they have to sign a code of conduct governing their interaction with minors. So if any one of these boundaries is crossed, right away we address the issue. And if there is not a change in procedure, then that person is either asked not to volunteer or, if they're employed, could be terminated in terms of employment. All our Catholic school teachers, all volunteers, attend boundary training. So we try to make sure that the young people are finding in the church these days a safe environment. In addition, we try to do all kinds of things with our priests, indicating there are certain things that are just not acceptable. One-on-one with a young person outside of confession, and even in confession, you know, has to be something that is just not taken for granted. I remember when I was pastor in a church in 2002, when the scandal first broke, I was in a rather large parish, and we had four confessionals, and I had all the doors in those confessionals changed from solid doors to glass, so that there was no possibility of a priest being alone with anybody in the confessional. Not being seen. Obviously, there was anonymity in terms of conversation, but you could see in the glass doors. And I think that things like that, making sure that we don't have any one-on-one contact with children, is a very important thing for us to follow through on. And lastly, we have a victim assistance coordinator, and her responsibility is to help individuals not only report allegations, but also to direct that person to appropriate counseling.
And lay people are involved in these oversight organizations as well, correct?
Oh, they're all lay people. The Office of Child Protection is directed by a lay person. The Victim Assistance Coordinator is a lay person. All of the folks who do the boundary training and the background checks, all of that, all lay folks, the background checks are done professionally by background screening organization.
With all the stuff that people have been doing, and we assume every diocese, particularly since 2002, it's almost inconceivable that some of these things are still going on in different places. I remember the St. Louis Post-Dispatch complained about the Vatican going after, quote, gay priests, unquote, and pushing them out of the seminaries. With all these safeguards, for Cardinal McCarrick to get away with continuing misconduct, it just seems to be impossible. He couldn't have done it without help.
No, and I think we have to look at the underlying problem here. And the underlying problem, I think, is clericalism, this whole idea of this clerical culture. And it seems to pervade, you know, we'll take care of our brothers in the priesthood. And even if they do things that are wrong, we won't report it. We won't do this. And that's got to go. That has to go. The only clerical culture we should have is that we should be helping each other in proclaiming the gospel and striving for holiness. And if we fail, we can't just close our eyes. You know, I come from New York, and of course, after 9/11 in New York City, I mean, there must be 45, 50,000 signs all over the city in subways, on buses, and everything else. And the signs say, if you see something, say something. I think that that's something we have to do in the church as well. And it should be directed not only at the laity, but at priests and as bishops as well. If we see something that doesn't seem appropriate, we have an obligation to face it and to deal with it and to confront someone who might be doing something that's inappropriate.
Have qualifications for being in the seminary changed?
Oh, my goodness, yes. Right now, for a seminarian to be admitted, I can speak for my own diocese here, our diocese. They go before a seminarian admissions board, which, again, is made up of priests, but we have a social worker, we have medical doctors, we have psychiatrists and religious sisters on this board as well. And the seminarian comes for an interview after having gone through a whole psychological evaluation by a psychologist. And it's a thorough, intense evaluation. The results of that evaluation are presented in a report for everyone on the board to see. And if there is anything in the person's background or anything in the psychological report that might be a red flag, we address it. And if we feel that there might be a problem with a person who is applying, we would reject that person. We then would recommend that person to a specific seminary. And there is a review board by the seminary as to whether or not this person is accepted. And then, of course, if it's a college seminary, we're looking at up to 8 years that they would be in seminary formation. If it's beyond college, it could be 4 or 5 years that they're in formation. And during all that time, there's all kinds of evaluation, academic, pastoral, psychological, emotional. So if there are any signs that there might be some difficulties, those things are clearly reported. And in some cases, seminarians have been asked to leave, or they come to the understanding themselves that this is not a life that they can live faithfully. So I think right now, my goodness, I think we're in really good shape in terms of our admissions process. And we have some really fine young men in the seminary these days.
And I don't want to say anything that would reflect badly, particularly on the seminarians today, since many of the changes have gone into effect. How are seminarians basically screened for chaste behavior? This is part of the problem. You said psychological evaluation, but what goes on with regard to chastity and being a chaste priest?
Well, Michael, that's a good question. You know, chastity is something that everyone is called to, and chastity is certainly to live according to one's state in life. You know, for the seminarian, obviously, the church asks men who are to be ordained priests to live a life of celibacy. And that is the way we live chastity as priests in the Roman Catholic Church. But of course, chastity covers a whole host of ways in which we can not live up to chastity. Some of them, of course, are very serious, and some of them are not quite so serious, but still are ways in which we fail. Certainly, one who is celibate is not expected to enter into any kind of a relationship with anyone that would be sexual in nature. And then, of course, we get to the point of not only the abandonment of the virtue of chastity, but we also get into the area of manipulation of other people. And so we think in terms of rape, and we think in terms of sexual abuse, manipulation of other people. That's a rather egregious and serious offense against chastity. So our seminarians are expected, first of all, to find out what is it that is necessary for them in their state of life to live a good, chaste life. And the way they come to that understanding, first of all, is through the efforts of a spiritual director. A spiritual director is a priest who is assigned to the seminarian and will spend a good amount of time with the seminarian discussing these issues of celibacy, discussing the issues of sexuality, of intimacy, and all of these things that are essential to live a good, holy, chaste life as priest. It's up to the seminarian then to take all of this in and to come to a discernment as to whether or not he can live this kind of a life. He does this with his own reflection, but he also does this with the advice of the spiritual director, the priest who has spent many, many hours with him in discussion concerning these very issues. It's critical that the seminarian has the experience of a good spiritual director. Most seminaries require that spiritual directors meet with their directees at least every 2 to 3 weeks. And those sessions are rather intense at times. I can remember for myself as a seminarian dealing with my own spiritual director, and some of those sessions were really rather eye-opening and rather deep and intense. But I must say,
they were critical in terms of my own understanding of what I was called to as a priest to live a chaste life.
Bishop, a follow-up question. How does the church choose spiritual directors for seminarians?
Well, a spiritual director for a seminary would be appointed by the local bishop, usually upon the recommendation of the rector of the seminary, and certainly upon the recommendation of other priests in the diocese. He has to be a man of good reputation. He has to be a man who's kind of renowned, would be a good word to use, renowned in terms of his own holiness and spirituality. I would say that it's probably one of the most important aspects of the life of the seminary, and certainly a bishop who appoints a spiritual director has a great responsibility to make sure that it's the right kind of person. Most of the spiritual directors would be priests who have been around for a while, priests who have had good experience in terms of pastoral ministry, in terms of formation, and who certainly whose reputation would be stellar.
And if the spiritual director finds a problem with one of the seminarians, I mean, what happens?
That's the part when you're talking about spiritual direction, conversations that occur in what we call the internal forum. In other words, it's bound by the seal of confession. So the spiritual director cannot do anything outside of that relationship that would compromise the confidentiality of the relationship. A good spiritual director, however, will make it a point to indicate very, very clearly to the seminarian if there's something wrong here.
But the role of the spiritual director is to make clear to the seminarian that if there are problems that come up with living of chastity, that he has to do two things. First of all, if they are problems of a psychological nature, that he has to seek help for that.
It is a seminarian who has to do something to repair whatever is wrong.
And secondly, if it is something that can't be dealt with or would go beyond the possibilities of living a chaste life, that person has to be asked by the spiritual director to leave the seminary. And that has happened. I know of situations where that has happened.
And of course, usually, in the external forum, those areas in which seminarians are evaluated by all of the other faculty in the seminary, and certainly by those people in parishes where the seminarian would do pastoral work, if there are difficulties, those things usually are seen. There are questions that are asked. And in the external forum, it's up to the evaluation team of a seminary to deal with those issues.
If there is a failure in chastity, and it is a failure that's normal human failure, that it can be corrected. If it turns out to be in any way considered emotionally or psychologically deficient, they should be asked to leave.
As you know, this time is a challenging time to be Catholic. What would you like to say to Catholics in the diocese who may be struggling with their faith right now because of the crisis?
That's a good question. I think the first thing that I would like to say to folks is remember that our faith focuses not on any priest or bishop or pope, that our faith focuses on Jesus Christ. That's number one. And that if we have difficulties with the church, and I can understand people having great difficulties with the church with these problems that we're dealing with now, that should not interfere with their relationship with God somehow or another. Even if they find that the church does not help them in their relationship with God, they have to remain faithful to God. So I encourage them to continue to pray, to continue to be in relationship with God. But I also indicate to them that as Catholics, we belong to a community that is only as strong as its weakest link. And we need people to repair the damage that has been done. We need people to challenge the leadership of the church to repair the damage that has been done. And I would encourage folks not to walk away. But, you know, folks have to follow their conscience. They have to do what they believe is the right thing. But I just hope that God continues to be in their picture of what is important in life. And I hope and pray that they will stay and help the church to repair this damage that has been done.
We've been speaking with Bishop Robert Guglielmone of the Diocese of Charleston. Bishop, we thank you for taking all this extra time out of your day to really address the flock here in the Diocese of Charleston and let them know what the diocese is doing during this crisis in the church and have the door open for anybody who wants to find out more, correct?
Absolutely, and we're planning to come out with a fact sheet that we can try to promote throughout the diocese to let people know precisely what is the reality of the present situation and what we're doing here in the Diocese of Charleston. And hopefully that we'll be able to publish that in the very near future.
Very good. Bishop, would you like to give a blessing to listeners today?
I certainly would. Gracious, loving God, we ask your presence in the lives of all of your people, and especially the folks here in the Diocese of Charleston. We ask your blessings upon them in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Amen. Amen. Thank you, Bishop.